Welcome to the Practical Employment Law Podcast, a podcast covering all aspects of American employment law. I'm your host, Mark Chumley. It's time again for an update on the latest in labor and employment law developments. To remind you, updates are all based on recent cases that have been decided, new laws that have been passed, and general news from the world of labor and employment law. I'm going to talk about three things today. First is the OSHA vaccine mandate rule for employers with over 100 employees. Second is the new arbitration decision from the Ninth Circuit that essentially eliminates arbitration in California. And third is a new lawsuit filed by the EEOC related to work-from-home arrangements. So let's jump right in. The biggest news in recent employment law history was the September 9th announcement from the Biden administration that all employers with more than 100 employees would be required to enforce a worker vaccine mandate or weekly testing. Now, obviously, there's no actual rule yet from OSHA, and despite a whole lot of speculation, no one really knows what this thing will look like, how employers would comply with it, or even if it ever happens. I'd love to make some kind of a prediction here, but I confess that I don't know what is going to happen with this. Instead, I'm going to give you a series of observations about this situation. Observation number one. The last time OSHA was tasked with issuing a COVID rule, it took them 6 months to issue something. Now, this new rule is supposed to come in a matter of weeks, but there is reason to be skeptical about that time frame. And even if it does come out in the near future, there will have to be some additional time frame for compliance. So on the whole, it probably makes sense to give the issue of compliance some thought in very broad terms, but mostly take a wait-and-see approach. There are just too many unanswered questions at this point to try to do something definitive. Observation number two. The Biden administration has directed OSHA to issue an emergency rule, which bypasses some of the normal rulemaking process. Now, OSHA has only issued 9 emergency rules ever, the last one in 1983, and of those, 4 were completely struck down by courts and a 5th was partially struck down. That's not a great track record, and there are a whole host of legal arguments and grounds to attack this new vaccine rule, and that's just based on the little we know. For example, why is an emergency rule necessary for employers with 101 employees, but not for employers with 99 employees? Why is the Postal Service apparently exempted, despite having a huge number of employees who interact extensively with the public? I'm not a fortune teller, but with all of these issues, it seems possible that this rule may never go into effect. And even if it does, it will likely generate a mountain of litigation that could further stall its enforcement. I can envision a line down the courthouse steps of lawyers waiting to file suit on behalf of employers and employees. Also, the rulemaking process remains in place after an emergency rule is issued, meaning that OSHA will have several hurdles to clear in a fairly short time frame after the rule is issued to justify it. These are an awful lot of legal issues to get around, and they involve an issue that is divisive and political. Observation number three. Take a look at the Department of Labor and OSHA websites. I did this morning. This announced rule is one of the biggest proposed regulations of the United States workforce in history. Yet there is not a word about it on either the Department of Labor or the OSHA websites. The only place it has ever been mentioned is on the White House website and in the president's speech. I don't know what that means, but it seems very odd to me. Observation number four. I don't believe that OSHA has the resources to enforce the rule as proposed. My understanding is that OSHA is pretty short-staffed as far as their existing duties go. While their jurisdiction is broad, most of their efforts are not surprisingly directed toward where they are most obviously relevant, in industrial workplaces where the risk of workplace injury is greatest, factories, warehouses, and so forth. OSHA doesn't spend a lot of time in the white-collar world in my experience, but this rule is not confined to industrial settings. Is OSHA really in a position to add this massive amount of work to their already overburdened staff? It seems unlikely. Observation number five. I'm no expert on human nature, but I have observed quite a bit of it in 25 years of practicing law, and I'm not convinced that people's first impulse will be to comply with this proposed rule. Many may agree to testing on a weekly basis and forego the vaccine. However, I'm inclined to believe that a lot of employees will quit their jobs or allow their employers to terminate them for noncompliance and seek unemployment benefits or look for work at smaller employers who are not covered by the rule. If that happens, what will become of the larger employers? Can a supermarket or event venue operate if it loses one-third or one-half of its employees? How about trucking companies or distribution centers? If this rule goes into effect and generates responses apart from compliance, it could have some serious ripple effects that might make politicians very uncomfortable. Keep in mind, these are just observations. I don't know what the rule will look like, and there are more questions than answers right now. The takeaway for employers is that it probably makes sense to wait and see what we are dealing with before doing much, because we simply cannot anticipate what steps will be necessary for compliance or when they might be necessary. Next, I want to consider a new arbitration decision from the Ninth Circuit that was issued on September 15th. The case is U.S. Chamber of Commerce versus Bonta, a Ninth Circuit decision. This case involves California Assembly Bill 51, which prohibits retaliation for refusing to consent to the waiver of rights and procedures. Now, arbitration is not singled out by the bill. It covers a large range of waivers, including non-disparagement clauses and non-disclosure agreements. But this is significant to arbitration because an arbitration agreement is essentially a waiver of the right to bring a case in court, which the bill would outlaw. Now, a lower court held that the Federal Arbitration Act was at odds with this state law, and therefore it could not be enforced. On appeal, the Ninth Circuit disagreed and held that the Federal Arbitration Act and Assembly Bill 51 were not in conflict. Now, here's the reasoning, and it's going to make your head hurt if you think about it for too long. The court held that because the conduct prohibited by the bill, demanding a waiver of the judicial forum, occurs before an arbitration agreement is entered into, it does not impact the enforceability of an arbitration agreement and therefore does not run afoul of the Federal Arbitration Act. Now that is one lawyerly argument. If you look at it a bit more broadly, it's clear that the bill prevents employers and employees from entering into arbitration agreements, at least mandatory ones, and in that sense, it does seem to run afoul of the Federal Arbitration Act. All of the recent Supreme Court cases on arbitration have been uniformly in favor of enforcement of arbitration agreements and against efforts to curtail the use of arbitration. It's likely that this case will be appealed, and if the Supreme Court hears it, my guess is that it will be overturned. However, in the meantime, Assembly Bill 51 stands in California, and employers are not going to be able to require employees to enter into arbitration agreements as a condition of employment until something changes. Finally, the EEOC recently filed a lawsuit over an employee's work-from-home arrangements. The case, which was filed in federal court in Georgia, involves a former health and safety manager. In March of 2020, at the outset of the pandemic, she requested an accommodation to work from home 2 days a week because of lung disease. Shortly after her request, her employer's staff went on modified work schedules where employees worked from home 4 days per week. In June of 2020, the employer required all staff to return to in-person work 5 days a week. The employee allegedly renewed her request at that point that she be allowed to work from home 2 days per week. According to the lawsuit, other employees were permitted to work from home, but the employer denied the health and safety manager's request to work from home, and she was later terminated for performance issues. And then, of course, this lawsuit followed. Now, a couple of points for employers from this lawsuit. First, the EEOC loves work-from-home arrangements as accommodations. Also, given the amount of employees who have worked from home in the past year and a half, it is difficult for employers to argue that it's not a reasonable accommodation, particularly if employees were effective while they worked from home. And if employers want to claim that they were not effective, were the issues documented? Remember one of my rules in employment law, if it's not in writing, it didn't happen. Also, another key point is disparate treatment. Are the standards for working from home applied uniformly? There may be good reasons why it's allowed for some employees to work from home and not others, but this issue needs to be handled consistently. In addition, this is not a decision that managers should make in a vacuum or on an ad hoc basis. I've run into several scenarios this year alone where employers have managers with inconsistent views on working from home, and they allow similarly situated employees to be held to different standards. This may be defensible in some cases, but the far safer approach for employers is to demand consistency on this issue. This has been the Practical Employment Law Podcast. Thanks for listening. Please watch for future episodes wherever you get podcasts. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave us a review. If you would like to contact me about any aspect of the podcast, my email address is mchumley@kmklaw.com, and my full contact information is in the show notes. This podcast was created for general informational purposes only and does not constitute legal advice or a solicitation to provide legal services. Although we attempt to ensure that the podcast is complete, accurate, and up to date, we assume no responsibility for its completeness, accuracy, or timeliness. The information in this podcast is not intended to create, and listening to it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Listeners should not act upon this information without seeking professional legal advice.